A reporter once asked Johnny Cash what his definition of success was. And Johnny Cash said, "Success means having to worry about every single thing in the world except money." And that, I think, would be a similar definition of success for King Solomon. We get to this point in the story of the Israelites, and finally, the Israelites have made it through the kingship of King Solomon. Solomon, you'll remember, was David's son. There are many stories that you may remember from Sunday school, that you may remember from previous lessons about wise old Solomon and the way that he wrote Proverbs and he wrote interesting pieces of material about wisdom in the Bible and how people want to emulate Solomon, follow him as an example about the wisdom that he had. And Solomon does show promise. Solomon, when he's given a choice, when God gives him the chance to build the temple, Solomon has a choice. He can either choose a kingship of glory or a kingship of wisdom. And the kingship of glory means that Solomon would be a glorious king, a wealthy king, a powerful king, a military ruler. And a kingship of wisdom means that he would be the kind of person who has a heart for his people. He would pray. He would be responsive to the Ten Commandments. He would do what God calls us to do. And that's what Solomon asks for before he builds the temple, earlier on in the book of Kings. Solomon chooses wisdom over kingship. But what this chapter, chapter 6, and the future chapters in 1 Kings show is that this wisdom really hangs by just a little string from a spider's web. That this ruling with wisdom is very precarious indeed, very dangerous. If he obeys, God will reward him. If Solomon does not, God will make a new plan. Now, where we are here with building of the temple and with Solomon is this is the brief moment when Israel has made it. This is the brief moment when Israel's bounds are as wide as they will ever be. We're told in the Old Testament how big a nation Israel is, and this is the broadest borders, the largest amount of square footage. And Solomon builds this temple for God to live in. And it's truly magnificent. It is expensive because not only did they quarry the stone and then bring it to the central location and put the temple together, but you couldn't see any stone. All the stone was covered with the cedar paneling on the inside, something that you wouldn't have had in your house and that I don't even know if wealthy people in Jerusalem would have had. This is one of those signs of how magnificent Solomon wanted this building to be for God. Yet there are a few things going on that remind us that this spider's web thread is kind of bearing an awful lot of weight. Solomon wasn't able to build this temple by himself. As a matter of fact, Solomon didn't pick up a hammer or an anvil or anything like that. He conscripted a whole bunch of people to build the temple. He raised taxes to build the temple. He built the temple on the backs of other people and upon other people's wealth. And Solomon gets to a point here where he gets so wrapped up in being a great administrator, in the wisdom that he has, that he forgets the main things. Solomon is so wrapped up in running his household and his kingdom. We're told in the scriptures that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now that takes some smarts to be able to figure out how to feed and clothe 700 wives and 300 concubines. Nonetheless, where to house them, right? So Solomon is busy doing all that, and he forgets the role that God has given him. Many of these marriages were marriages of convenience. They were marriages that Solomon made so that he could marry a princess in another country, and that king would then not declare war against Israel. So many of these marriages were marriages of convenience. They were political marriages. And Solomon didn't seem to mind too much or care too much or notice too much when these women brought their gods into Solomon's palace. Now, I should tell you something right there about missing the point. Remember back on Mount Sinai, God said something to Moses, really important. He gave them these 10 rules, 10 commandments, right? You shall have no other gods before me. And Solomon is now marrying for convenience and is just trying to get along and trying to make sure that he can consolidate his power, and he's forgotten the importance of having no other gods before the God of Israel. And then a lot of what happens in Israel as Solomon gets wealthier, as he's got more mouths to feed, the poor are not receiving the same justice as the rich. If you didn't have someone who could plead your case, if you didn't have some money to plead your case, you were out of luck. And the labor in building the temple and in building up Jerusalem wasn't seen as something that was fulfilling for a person. It wasn't seen as something that could make a good career. But rather, the labor was seen as duty. Solomon could compel you to work for the temple. He could underpay you, because who's going to tell Solomon no? He could make you a slave. And if slavery allows this beautiful temple to be built cheaper, if slavery allows the paneling to be put up at a lower cost, why not? So the thinking goes. And Solomon forgot that God has a heart for the slave and for the hardworking person, that God has a heart for the poor, and that success should not come on the back of other people. Under Solomon, the foundation was laid. It was all set out. It was all ready to go. And it falls apart. I don't know if any of you have read the William Faulkner books about the Compson family. But the Compson family is a wealthy family after the Civil War who watches their fame and fortune evaporate. They're a very proud family. They have old money. They're the old South. But as they get into more and more financial difficulties, as they continue to fight with one another, as they are more and more dysfunctional, people sort of drift away into alcoholism, and they drift away into spending beyond their means, and greed and racism and dysfunction. And at the end of the Compson stories, this is told primarily in The Sound and the Fury and Absalom, Absalom, two books by William Faulkner. At the end of the story, they are mere shells of what they used to be. Their land, as a matter of fact, they used to have a big, gigantic farm, and they had sold it off to make a golf course. And the beautiful southern manor in which they inhabit is falling down around them. It's a warning tale for all of us, a tale worthy of Solomon. Success cannot come on the backs of others. Success cannot come upon our dysfunction. Cannot be built on our dysfunction or our greed or our hope for the glory days. And if you really want to know something about success, you really have to contrast what goes on here with Solomon with Jesus. You remember the Sermon on the Mount? Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 is, many people think it's sort of the New Testament counterpart to those Ten Commandments I mentioned earlier. Jesus doesn't give Ten Commandments, but he does go up on the Mount and he gives some new rules for living. And listen to what you hear there. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. It's really interesting to me. Jesus doesn't mention one time success, but he mentions blessing. And when he mentions blessing, it's not a category any of us would want to be in. I don't want to be the poor in spirit. I don't want to be the one who is mourning. I don't want to be the one who is persecuted. But Jesus says that those blessings are much more important. Those blessings are much more realistic than our definitions of success. And maybe success has very little to do with 700 wives and 300 concubines. Maybe the point of this passage in 1 Kings is that success has nothing at all to do with that. Maybe that's the hint itself, that it's tipping in the wrong direction, that we should be saying to Solomon, watch out, it's all going to go away. And that's exactly what happened. Solomon starts to lose his grip like that. Maybe we need to find different ways to define success. Last month, 2 months ago now, when we had the Filipino guests with us, as we were driving out of export for the last time, the bishop looked at the church here as we're driving along Hills Church Road, and he said to me, he said, never in all my life did I think I would preach at such a magnificent building as Hills Church on Hills Church Road. You ever thought of this building as magnificent? Have you ever thought of this building as success? I took him around to a couple other churches, and all three of the Filipino pastors were amazed at the size of sanctuaries, of buildings, of Christian education wings. That's one kind of success, I guess. But then I remembered my visit there a little over 2 years ago, and most of their church buildings consist of a sanctuary, period. No church office, and if they do have one, it's a tiny office. I don't know where they do their copying. I don't know where the copy machine was. Never saw one of them. There's one church, my favorite visit of the whole 2 weeks. It was one church they met in a carport. That was their sanctuary. That was their church building. Not just their sanctuary. It was their church building. They would open it up, and there, sitting in the sanctuary, they had these white chairs that you get at Walmart, you know, the plastic chairs that you can buy for the season. And that was their sanctuary. You could move them around any way you wanted. There was no organ. There was no particular things on the walls that identified it as any sort of great, important church. But the day we were there, they were having vacation Bible school. And the day we were there, we could hear, as we were walking up the alleyway, because it's not on the main street, it's on one of the The unpaved back alleyways is where this carport was. As we were walking up the alleyway, you could hear the kids singing their vacation Bible school songs. And it made my heart glad. You could hear them, and their voices were echoing all through the neighborhood. And kids were running around. It was chaos. It was totally, totally crazy. Kids were running around. And I think that was part of their evangelism strategy. You open up the doors and you start to sing, and kids will gradually sort of, you know, they don't want to be left out of anything. They want to be included. And so there we sat in 98 degree heat in a little carport. And they got out some orange juice for us and some sort of cookie. And we ate snack with about 25, 30 little kids. And I thought, yeah, this is success. This is success. You don't need all the things that we think we have to have. We don't need all the things we think we must have. Sure, that little church pales in comparison to Solomon and 700 wives and 300 concubines. But on the other hand, I don't think I'd trade it for anything. Amen.